It is 5 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Libyan authorities insist they've seized oil tanker loaded by armed militia. Somali African Union troops push al-Shabaab militants out of key southern towns. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. Libyan officials say government forces seized a tanker loaded with crude oil that a separatist militia was attempting to export in defiance of the country's central authority. The vessel, Morning Glory, is North Korea flagged, but it's unclear who actually owns it. Meanwhile, Libya's parliament ordered special forces to deploy within a week to liberate all rebel-held ports in the country's volatile east. At UN headquarters Monday, the seizure of Libya's ports has been discussed. Tarek Mitri, the special representative of the UN Secretary General and head of the UN's support mission to Libya, warned of unprecedented violence facing the North African country.
Nationwide demonstrations have taken place since early February against the continued tenure of the General National Congress. Strong resentment and animosity has grown between the two main, though not homogeneous, camps. Libya faces the risk of embarking on a new trajectory of unprecedented violence.
Libya has tried to rebuild its army since the 2011 overthrow of dictator Muammar Gaddafi. Somali troops and African Union forces recaptured a number of towns from al-Shabaab militants in what they say is a renewed effort to dislodge the group from its strongholds in the country. One of the areas is the town of Berthubo, which was one of al-Shabaab's biggest bases in southern Somalia. Troops from the African Union mission in Somalia, known as AMBASOM, and the Somali National Army retook control Sunday after a day of fighting. Colonel Ali Hamoud, an AMBASOM spokesman, told VOA al-Shabaab fighters are retreating when they see AMBASOM forces approach, but that it remains to be seen if they're planning to engage in guerrilla warfare.
Anything that can happen, and we are prepared for that.
Other towns the Somali army and AMBASOM have reclaimed since Friday are in Gedo and Bakool regions next to the Ethiopian border and a few hundred kilometers from the capital Mogadishu. Colonel Hamoud told VOA the operation will continue but could not say for how long.
It will depend on the different sectors, but I'm sure we are going to succeed, and we'll have many other towns to capture as soon as possible.
Meanwhile, al-Shabaab leader Ahmed Abdi Godane has issued an audio message calling for jihad against what he called Ethiopian and other AMBASOM interveners. An international commission of inquiry is embarking on an investigation into alleged human rights violations in Central African Republic involving mostly Muslim Salika and anti-Balaka militia. Lisa Schlein reports the commission will spend 3 days in the capital Bangui, then move to the country's interior over the course of the next 2 weeks.
Commission Chairman Bernard Achomuna is a lawyer and advocate to the Cameroon Supreme Court. He recently returned from a visit to Bangui and says there is a total breakdown of law and order in the country.
When I was there 2 weeks ago, there was a definite feeling that this must stop, and therefore the government of transition is emphasizing that we have to put an end to impunity.
Commissioner Muna says the commission will explore every avenue of concern throughout the country.
We have to see the camps where people are interned. We have to talk to people in the villages. We have to have a feel of the menace that they have faced.
In recent months, tens of thousands of Muslims have fled their homes in Western CAR, fearing attacks by the largely Christian anti-Balaka group. Muna says he views genocide as a serious possibility, and the international community must not wait until genocide has been committed before taking action. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Meanwhile, CAR officials were paid their first monthly wage in 6 months on Monday. In Mozambique, flooding has inundated the southern part of the country, prompting authorities to call for an evacuation. Some 6,000 people are believed to be impacted by the flooding in the Inkomati Basin. Morocco's finance minister on Monday urged U.S. businesses to boost their investments in the country and take advantage of what he calls unprecedented growth in the region. Speaking during a bilateral business conference in Rabat Monday, Mohamed Hussein said trade between the two countries has risen fourfold between 2005 and 2012 to $4 billion. Morocco has struggled to recover from the financial crisis that has affected Europe, its number one trading partner, and has struggled to contain a ballooning public debt. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Batte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, March 11th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Africa is calling Africans to discuss AU Vision 2063 this Saturday, March 15th.
We want business people to participate. We want the women to participate. We want the youth to participate in this discussion of the future of Africa. These are the people who have always been missing in all these discussions.
Chika Onyeni is a Nigerian and chairman of the Celebrate Africa Foundation. An influential civic organization is calling for term limits for Malawi members of parliament. Malnutrition is on the rise for children in northern Cameroon. And South Sudan says journalists cannot broadcast interviews with rebels allied to former Vice President Riek Machar.
The media is free in South Sudan according to the law. But in practice, any freedom that you exercise it in according to the law. And if you step on the toes of others, then you are in violation of the law.
Michael Makwe is South Sudan's information minister and government spokesman. There is a looming battle for gold in Uganda's Karamoja region, and global food diets are becoming more and more similar. Those stories plus Mark Oman, sports and our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. On January 24th this year, African Union Commission Chairperson Nkosi Zana Dlamini Zuma released her vision for Africa's future. Among other things, the Africa Agenda 2063 rekindles the passion for Pan-Africanism. It calls for promotion of peace and stability, expansion of agricultural production, inclusive economic development and industrialization, and mainstreaming women and youth participation in all activities of the African Union. This Saturday, March 15th, Africans on the continent and in the diaspora are being invited to attend a conference call to discuss Dlamini Zuma's vision. Chika Onyeni is publisher of the African Sun-Times newspaper based in New York and chairman of the Celebrate Africa Foundation. He tells me this is the time for ordinary Africans to make their voices heard.
This conference call is not about intellectuals. We want every African to participate. For too long, it has been confined to the intellectual class. We want business people to participate. We want the women to participate. We want the youth to participate in this discussion of the future of Africa. These are the people who have always been missing in all these discussions. And moreover, the most important thing is that African Union doesn't have to spend money organizing another intellectual discussion about this document she has put out.
Chika, I want to ask you, let's get it out of the way. Did the African Union ask you to organize this discussion?
No. I did not consult them before organizing it. If they want to participate, they can participate. But we are not begging them to participate. This is for us Africans. It has taken too long that we are always waiting for the leadership in Addis Ababa to ask us to do something or to do something. Can you imagine what would have happened, James? If we had had this kind of discussion before, would Africans have agreed for the Chinese to bring a paltry $200 million to build our headquarters? I mean, it's a total disgrace.
As I look at this Vision 2063, I say, okay, where is the fight against corruption in this agenda? Because I'm sure if you talk to the ordinary African, he or she would tell you that official corruption in Africa is what is mostly what has been eating away the soul of Africans.
She has addressed that issue of corruption, how we can fight it. And under a United States of Africa or Confederation of African States or Union of African States, that would be one of the priorities. These are some of the things, the issues that the people of Africa, through this discussion, will be able to talk about corruption in Africa. We should make our voices heard. Africans should make their voices heard about corruption in Africa.
So, Chika, this conference call, what day is it going to be taking place again?
It's going to be taking place on Saturday the 15th. On the East Coast, it will be at 5 p.m. On the West Coast, it will be at 2 p.m. In Central Time, it will be at 4 p.m.
So if someone is in Africa and they want to join in, what would you want to tell them?
Well, for For instance, there are people from Nigeria, Ghana. Of course, from Ghana, that will be at 8 p.m. From South Africa, that will be at 11 p.m. From Nigeria, at 10 p.m. From Ghana, at 9 p.m. From Kenya, from Addis Ababa, it will be at 12 p.m.
Chika Onyeni is a Nigerian and chairman of the Celebrate Africa Foundation. He was speaking with me from New York. South Sudan government spokesman Michael Makui says the media in Juba do not have the right to broadcast interviews with rebels allied to former Vice President Riek Machar. Makui warns that the government will punish any media organization that gives airtime to the rebels. He accuses South Sudanese journalists of making mistakes as they cover the crisis in their country.
What happened is that when I was in Addis in the talks, one of the reporters of iRadio interviewed one of the rebel leaders there in Addis. The rebel leader was very clearly demanding that Salva must go and that they are for a regime change and that Salva must resign and that an interim government should be set up. The recorded material was brought and played in iRadio here in Juba. The security organs went to them and asked them what it is. They said that this was an interview. The man was arrested. He's under investigation. When I came from Addis, this was reported to me, and I talked to the journalists. I told them, I'm advising you not to commit such a mistake. What is it now when you go and interview a rebel who ran away from here? Then you come and play that interview in a government territory, and you know this man is not friendly. This is not the meaning of journalism.
You're a lawyer by profession. The Constitution of South Sudan guarantees freedom of speech. And these journalists
I'm saying the Constitution guarantees the right of speech, the right of freedom of speech, freedom of movement, but according to the law. Every freedom has its own limitations. And once it is abused, you have gone beyond that.
Today, if I'm a journalist in South Sudan and I interview Dr. Riek Machar, what kind of charges will be brought against me according to the laws of South Sudan?
You interview him outside, publish it, whatever you do, publish it outside. But when you come and disseminate these poisonous information inside South Sudan, it is an offense.
Under which penal code of the law in South Sudan?
Are you interviewing me on my own laws? What? I said it is an offense according to the law, full stop. It is not my duty to tell which law. Go and look for it.
South Sudan is a democratic country. The president is democratically elected. The sign of democracy is free media. Now, if they are putting these laws to journalists, is the media free in South Sudan?
The media is free in South Sudan according to the law. There is nowhere where it is free. Even in America, where you are, it is not free. Don't be misled by words which I said. But in practice, any freedom that you exercise it in according to the law. And if you step on the toes of others, then you are in violation of the law.
Michael Makui is South Sudan's information minister and government spokesman. He was speaking with John Tanza of VOA South Sudan in Focus program. Two influential civic organizations in Malawi are calling for term limits for members of parliament. The two are the Council for Non-Governmental Organizations in Malawi and the Catholic Commission for Justice and Peace. They say members of parliament should have the same term limits as their president. Voice Umhoni is chairman of the Council for Non-Governmental Organizations in Malawi. He tells reporter Peter Clotty that term limits would encourage new ideas as well as the youth to fully participate in the country's democracy.
Really, it's an idea that has popped up because in Malawi we have a democratic system. And so far, we have some members of parliament who have been there for more than 40 years, meaning more than 8 terms. And now it's an idea that is coming out so that we marry this idea with the term limit that is given to the president.
That means you're calling for a constitutional change. Do you foresee this happening? And because this same parliamentarians would have to be involved in this constitutional maneuver.
Yeah, we know that parliamentarians have a high interest on this issue, but we'll be looking at an avenue whereby we are going to engage the citizens of Malawi. And the citizens of Malawi should pass on the message to the parliamentarian. We have a belief that some of the parliamentarians are in the youth group. And those will be our entry point, because we think that the youth group in the parliament will take this issue positively. Why I am saying this is that in Malawi, the youth composed of almost 51-52% of the population. So this move will give a chance to the youth to exercise their democratic rights, as well as to carry the powers there be.
Young and poor aspirants can't get into leadership positions because MPs, the old incumbent legislators, use everything at their disposal to cling to power. But this is practiced the world over. So why do you think it should be different in Malawi?
Yes, it's practiced the world over. But probably the worry is that some of the MPs, or most of them, who have been there for more than two terms, they are not bringing anything new to the community. And in Malawi, politics revolves on taking advantage of poverty of other people. So we know that the other people, they have ideas, they have the passion to save their country, to transform their constituencies. But they cannot stand against the incumbent MP. And therefore, we are saying we should give a chance to other people.
Voice Umhoni is the chairman of the Council for Non-Governmental Organizations in Malawi. He spoke with reporter Peter Claudia from the capital, Lilongwe. It is Tuesday morning, March 11th, and you are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 17 minutes past the hour. Some 100,000 children, including Nigerian refugees, fleeing attacks from the extremist Islamist group Boko Haram, are suffering from acute malnutrition in northern Cameroon. Hospitals are overwhelmed. Health officials and United Nations agencies have been visiting the children and are promising assistance. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports for VOA from Yaoundé.
Badin Manstu cries as a five-year-old child is buried near her house in Marwa, northern Cameroon. She told VOA the child lost weight and died at a private hospital 2 hours after she was admitted. She blamed the staff for not attending to her immediately when she arrived. Hospital staff say they are overwhelmed. Mama Catherine is one of them.
As you can see for yourself, there are so many patients that we can attend to. We lack infrastructure. We lack staff. So what is certain is that some of the children whose lives may have been saved may end up dying.
Aida Maimunatu, who is at the hospital with her baby, is getting impatient. She says when her first child was not well, she took him to a traditional healer and he died. Now she has brought her second child to the hospital because the government is asking people not to go for traditional treatment. But she says, since I came here, nobody has attended to me. Among the malnourished children are Nigerian refugees fleeing from the Islamist militant sect Boko Haram. At their camp in Menowo in Mayocha Naga Division, where 7,000 refugees live, more than 300 children are suffering. Comfort Manda, who says she fled Borno State, says she has lost a child to malnutrition.
My brother, it is very difficult. I don't know how I'll tell you, but the situation that I met here is too deplorable that I don't know what to do now. Because I came in from Nigeria and my two children were sick. I've taken the two children to the hospital. I've not even been able to provide for their medicines. One of them has already died.
Dr. Nancy Elvis says the crisis is aggravated because refugees have to compete with the local population for food and water. The doctor says the government of Cameroon is not doing enough to reduce cases of malnutrition. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Having lost their traditional herds, the local people of Karamoja, Uganda, have increasingly turned to small-scale gold mining as a meager but fairly steady source of income. But with large mining interests moving into the region, even their gold could soon be taken from them. Hilary Hilo has more for VOA from Karamoja, Uganda.
As a child, Livingston Akuru's world revolved around cows. His family's herd was large, over 100 animals. Akuru lives in Karamoja, northeastern Uganda, and his people, the Karamojong, have long been semi-nomadic pastoralists. Livestock is at the heart of their culture, and a man's worth is counted in cattle. But more importantly, explains Akuru, cows have kept his people alive for centuries in a harsh, dry land.
When you have animals, there you can shed blood of the animal and you eat. You can eat meat there, you can get milk there. So there's no any more hunger there. They can survive if the animals are there.
But a combination of forced disarmament, drought, and disease has taken its toll, and the cows of Karamoja are disappearing. Akuru's family has only a handful of animals left, and he was forced to find other ways to survive. Like tens of thousands of Karamojong, he turned to gold. Now, Akuru spends his days hacking away at the bottom of a dry riverbed, mixing the earth with water and painstakingly sifting the mud for tiny gleaming nuggets to sell at the market. Sometimes he makes up to $3 a day. Other days, he says, he finds nothing at all.
Like now, for example, if you have not already any work, that means that you will sleep hungry. If you have not found it, no food. It is not easy also to get. The gold itself, you use a lot of strength, energy like that, and it is not every day that you can go and get it.
Simon Nanyero, head of the Karamoja Miners Association, estimates that around 80,000 people in the region make a living panning for gold. Crops in Karamoja often fail, and there's little industry. Without the gold, he says, he doesn't know what else they would do to survive.
You know, the Karamojong region didn't know about any other thing apart from looking after their animals. So people looked for alternatives. So more and more numbers are going for mining because it's the easiest way to get money.
But change is coming fast. Recently, international mining companies have begun exploration in Karamoja, looking for limestone, marble, iron ore, and, of course, gold. A Human Rights Watch report released February called attention to the threat these companies could pose if communities aren't properly consulted. Because land in Karamoja is communally owned, it said, the potential for land grabbing is very real. Hilary Hewler for VOA News, Karamoja.
Around the world, our plates are looking more and more the same. According to a new study, several crops have risen to dominate global food supplies. As VOA's Steve Baragona reports, the study carries both good and bad news.
National food supplies have become less dependent on a single crop, according to the study in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. But today's globalized diet centers around just a handful of crops, which the researchers say raises food security concerns. In China, for example, rice is still the top crop, making up about one-third of the average person's calories from plants per day. But the Chinese now eat almost as much wheat as rice. Colin Khoury at the International Center for Tropical Agriculture is lead author of the study. He spoke to VOA by Skype.
So what we see as the major crops become more important in more places for more people is that the regionally important, locally important crops are becoming marginalized.
For instance, Chinese sweet potato consumption fell from 20% of daily calories in 1961 to 2.9% in 2009, the latest data available. Khoury says that makes those few dominant crops even more important.
Those crops themselves need to be resilient, need to be productive year after year after year.
That means preserving genetic diversity to safeguard against new threats to productivity from climate change or other factors. And it means improving the nutritional content of the crops that make up a growing part of our diet, Khoury said. Climate change and the environmental risks of current agricultural practices make some of the marginalized crops more attractive.
These crops have a lot of potential.
Danielle Nierenberg is head of the Washington-based research institute Food Tank. She was not involved in the research, but she notes these underappreciated crops are often highly nutritious and can grow in harsh conditions.
The problem has been that the investment has not gone towards these things. It's gone toward the starchy, stable crops.
The study also notes that some of the world-conquering crops are key ingredients in unhealthy diets. Oil crops, such as soybean, palm, and sunflower, as well as sugar, have seen substantial growth in the last 50 years. But increasing consumption of high-calorie foods made with these crops is associated with diabetes, heart disease, and cancer. The researchers find signs of a shift in response to health, environmental, and climate concerns, beginning in Northern Europe. And they say further diversifying the food supply could encourage the trend. Steve Baragona, VOA News, Washington.
time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Mark Owoma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with athletics. Kenya is bidding to host the 2017 IWF World Youth Championships in the capital, Nairobi. Athletics Kenya head Isaiah Kiplagat told the local media on Monday. So far, Canadian cities of Montreal, Ottawa and Toronto are the only others bidding to stage the event. The Athletics World Governing Body, IWF, will name the successful candidate city in Monaco in November. Meanwhile, Ethiopians Gebo Burka and Amane Gobena carried the day in the men's and women's event at the Los Angeles Marathon in California State, USA on Sunday. Elsewhere, a new generation of young promising Ghanaian girls left their mark at the United States Junior College Indoor National Championships in New York City over the weekend. Elizabeth Dabzi won the girls' heptathlon, while Lydia Mato was victorious in 3,000 meters, 5,000 meters and 1 mile. Agnes Abu prevailed in the 800 meters and 1,000 meters. Sprinter Janet Amponsa clinched the silver and gold medals in 60 meters and 200 meters respectively. Her 200 meter winning time of 23.81 seconds is a Ghana indoor record. Adelaide Nkrumah bagged a bronze medal in the 600 meters. The athletes are in American colleges since January on scholarships from the Ghana Education Trust. Turning to golf, South African Jake Ross won a tightly contested Barclays Kenya Open Golf Championships in the Kenyan capital Nairobi on Sunday. For the second time in as many appearances, Denmark's Larsen Jensen was runner-up. Three golfers tied in second place. These are Jensen, Frenchman Adrian Bernadette, and Spain's Pedro Oriol. In Uganda, Monica Ntege beat a field of 38 competitors to win the Entebbe Ladies Open Golf Challenge. She clinched Uganda's most prestigious women's golf title that was last year won by Tanzanian Ed Medina. Finally, in polo, Ghana beat their visitors Canada 6-3 in a friendly polo match played in Accra on Friday. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
And thank you, Monk. Have a great day. Here's our listener mail for this Tuesday morning, March 11th.
I wish to call on Nigerian government as a matter of urgency, bring a lasting solution or solutions to this current scarcity of fuel biting very hard in the country. Nigerians are suffering, our country and oil producing nation in the world. What a shame in a country like ours where we produce the crude oil, etc. Comrade Marcy Patrick Okoro Krafo, Old Blue Village, Arjugu, in Abia State, Nigeria.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to DaybreakAfrica at voanews.com. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The United Nations says attacks in Sudan's long-troubled Darfur region have forced more than 45,000 people to flee their homes. A UN spokesman says the violence took place in the southern Darfur region of Gounia, with many people fleeing to the state capital, Nyala. That's it for this Tuesday, March 11th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Tracy Carter, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Mark Ouma, along with our engineer Carl Sterling, I'm James Butte in Washington, saying have a lovely day, Africa.
What's going on? What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We love to have you on board. This is Upfront on the Voice of America. Hot, hot.
Upfront is a show that explores issues
that affect your daily lives. Don't move. Don't move that dial. Put your feet up. This is Upfront. Cheers, cheers. Clink, clink. Yeah.
Now there's the youth culture that is being practiced by the youth globally.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I feel like the problem is that once the funds are sent to these developing countries, it sometimes gets in the wrong hands, and then it's the actual people that are supposed to be benefiting from these funds really never even get to see.
Let's start off by listening in on how young people view the concept of entrepreneurship in Africa. You can follow me on Twitter. My handle is at Upfront Africa. And remember, you can always send us an email here on the show. It's upfront@voanews.com.